if you don't mind, I think we will make a start. When the Rural Strategy Group decided on this topic, biofuels, the path to redemption or the road to ruin, a little while back, I don't think even we realised just how timely this topic was going to be now.
At the Church of England's General Synod last month, the bishops took a little time off from discussing whether women or gay people should join them in the purple. They paused to consider the morality of biofuels. The Bishop of Exeter is speaking.
There's the issue of the increasing amounts of crops such as maize being used for ethanol production.
And here are the bishops of Dudley and Worcester and Hereford.
We do need, obviously, to feed people first.
Absolutely right. And it also needs us to look more carefully at the development and use of all our land. We do need to value it. We need to see that it's gift, that it's precious, that it has to be valued, and not just therefore in the economic sense, but in the sense that it is gift and that we are given it to use in the best possible way. And part of the best possible way is to feed us and to care for the land and to care for one another and not to be profligate with it.
Whether or not you share the theological perspective, the bishops nailed a critical link in the current food crisis between what we eat and what we grow. What our countryside is for. Food, wildlife, leisure, fuel. It's strange that biofuels should be singled out for disapproval, because for years farmers have been encouraged to do almost anything with their land except produce food with it. 6 years ago, a report commissioned by Tony Blair said that British farming was unsustainable, dysfunctional, and advised farmers to diversify away from growing food. And they have. For example, Chris Murray runs a farm in Devon devoted to letting the public cuddle his animals. We heard from him in the first programme of this series, but he's hardly unique.
Diversification with farmers, certainly in Devon and most of the West Country now, has grown enormously. And when I was at Seal Hain, I did a postgraduate year there in farm management and economics, and they did a special section on alternative farming. In other words, non-agricultural things. So it'd be things like riding schools, adding value, having a farm tourist attraction. And at that time, we were ridiculed by other students called Playboys. And that was back in 1973, 1974. By now, in 2008, I would say something like 90% of Devon farmers get income from elsewhere.
For the last few years, more and more money from Europe and our own government has been ploughed into supporting rural people and wildlife, not the productive fields. But as world food prices soar, that's changing. And in the Cotswolds, farmer Adam Henson sees profits following the plough once again.
We're standing looking over a few fields. Round the outside of this field is a narrow band, about 24 metres, of spring barley. Now, this used to be set aside, but at the end of last year, set aside came to an end. And because spring barley is selling for such a good price, we decided it wasn't worth leaving it in grass, and we ploughed it up and have planted spring barley.
Set aside was land which farmers were in effect paid not to farm in order to prevent overproduction of food. That's why we had it, but it had useful green side effects too.
Set aside brought a huge amount of environmental benefit to the countryside, and on my farm, just the same as hundreds of others. Where we left it as permanent set aside, it offered quite a wide range of biodiversity for invertebrates and then vertebrates and predator birds, you know, owls and hawks and those sorts of things. And also, where we left it for a long period of time, because set aside has been around for tens of years, the grasses re-established themselves as sort of old Cotswold grasses with lots of valuable species in them. So it's been a bit of an environmental impact to plough them all up. But as farmers, we need to make hay while the sun shines. And so to leave set aside because you've got a few skylarks in it, when it can be bringing you in a nice bit of income, is a very difficult decision to make.
Mark Hill is a food and agriculture analyst at business advisory firm Deloitte. He sees the British countryside becoming more hostile for wildlife as farmers follow the money.
If prices go up, they will take on the most profitable enterprises. Grain production, with current prices, is one of the most attractive enterprises you can get into, more so than livestock enterprises. Consequently, farmers have responded by effectively redeploying their land resource, taking it out of grass and putting it into arable production, into grains. We're seeing much more of our landscape in arable crops now than we did 3 or 4 years ago. We're seeing far fewer livestock, and my concern is that you will, after a period of time, lose the skill base of animal husbandry in that as well.
These changes away from environmentally friendly farming are now driven mostly by the market. But Chris Haskins, Lord Haskins, who used to be Tony Blair's rural czar, predicts government policy will refocus on production.
I think there's no doubt that farming will become more important from the government's point of view for a start. You know, obviously they'd be much more interested in domestic production of food than they were. The farmers themselves will be more interested with these prices, and therefore there will be pressure to improve the productivity of the countryside in terms of farming. That inevitably is going to bring some sort of clash with policies which are promoting the environment at the expense of conventional farming. There is going to be a difficulty, no doubt. The tensions have gone from being the farmers dominant in post-war Europe, where producing food was all that mattered and the environment didn't matter, till in the last 10 or 15 years the environmentalists tend to dominate and the farmers don't matter. Now the pendulum is bound to swing back in the next few years in this country.
The National Farmers Union has always championed food production, especially when sandwiched between subsidies, and they've been suspicious of the trend for environmental payments. I caught up with the NFU's president, Peter Kendall, at New Covent Garden Fruit and Veg Market. He had just finished a promotional push for British horticulture and is clearly enjoying the new world order.
Farming and food production is back on the public agenda, and that does mean the politicians want to come and talk about what we do rather than thinking that farming is a problem and a pain in the backside.
You used to have a slogan, farming matters. Now in the past I always thought that was rather aspirational on your part, you wished it did, but I guess now you feel that's a statement of fact.
We were making the point 2 years ago when we started that slogan at a time when senior politicians were sending out messages that said, actually you can all be park keepers, we don't need your food. So we had to, in that point, engage in food production alongside managing the environment, increasing biodiversity, the value to the rural communities, post offices, the way of life, the distinction of being British. It was actually really quite airy-fairy. You know, a government that's basically said our food security policy is to have open borders. We're a rich country and we can buy it wherever we feel the need to buy it from. The only targets that the Treasury set, DEFRA at this moment in time, the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, are on climate change and biodiversity. Nothing about food production. We've got a great example actually currently going on in North Norfolk, where they're talking about flooding many, many square miles of the countryside. And when they do the cost-benefit analysis, they look at wading birds, for example, say this is going to be great for biodiversity, and we don't mind if grade one soil is flooded. We need a different approach.
This conflict between wildlife-friendly wetland versus food-rich farmland stretches inland too.
I'm Jimmy Hull, tenant of this farm, Gibsley Coal Farm, Wyn Marley.
I'm Leslie Hull, farming in partnership with my father, James Hull. 200 dairy cows plus followers, a few sheep, growing crops of grass, wheat and maize.
Jimmy and Leslie Hull are two Lancashire farmers who are upset by an official policy which they believe ranks our food below natural habitats. They say last summer's flooding cost them 600 litres of milk a day because green favouritism meant the Environment Agency wouldn't maintain the drainage of land beside a neighbouring species-rich peat bog.
There was the new Environment Agency's policy of only cleaning the adjoining ditches out of the main ones every 2 years. And they didn't do them in 2006, so there was already grassed over in the bottom. And they didn't come back and do them in 2007 until the end of August, beginning of September, before they let the water go off us.
These dikes here you're looking at here, are our, we maintain these. And it's all right, we keep ours maintained, but if somebody downstream doesn't do theirs, like the Environment Agency, what chance have we? There's a conflict here between what they want to do with the peat bog and us farming next to it, i.e. they're holding the water in the peat bog. If it's residential, it's important, or if it's a business, but farming, they haven't to bother about it. One of the Environment Agency officials once told me in this yard, it might be cheaper to bring milk in from France and Italy than try producing it on this land, when he was warning me that we weren't going to do the ditches. Doesn't food come first?
Not necessarily. Clearly it's up to all of us, not just farmers, to join in the growing debate on how our countryside is used. Green energy is an emerging priority. We've already seen the conflicts over wind farms, but could biofuels be the next battlefield? So far, little land has been sown with fuel, but with the so-called second-generation technologies, that could change. The argument often put forward for these crops, like elephant grass, is that they can be grown on land that wouldn't be used for food. Amid a field of elephant grass, I spoke to Andrew Lovett from the University of East Anglia about whether people are prepared for the countryside to be covered with this bioenergy crop.
We did a questionnaire survey of over 400 people last summer, and we showed pictures of these crops in different landscape settings to people in different town centres, and the great majority of the people did not think that they were out of place in the landscape.
But the very fact that you're investigating this suggests that people are concerned with changes of land use about how they're going to change the view of the countryside around us. Is that right, that that's the foundation of your work?
That was something that we were asked to investigate, because these crops grow very rapidly. They can grow to 3 metres high in a summer. In some cases, they are being planted in fields that previously had arable crops in them, so clearly they make the landscape look rather different. I would also say it's some of the poorer quality agricultural land that might not produce such higher yields of some of these crops, and which farmers might leave in set aside if economic returns were not so high.
You admit there would be an impact on yield, food yield?
There could be, yes.
So I guess it's a trade-off about how the public want their land to be used.
Yes, and whether they want energy from certain sources and the costs that they're willing to pay for it compared to the costs that they're willing to pay for their food.
If we want beautiful, species-rich landscape with grazing animals rather than endless wheat prairies or fields of 10-foot elephant grass, we can make that choice. But there's an often overlooked ethical question. In times of global food shortage, should we preserve our own pristine environment at the expense of someone else's? Given our own incredibly fertile countryside, is there a moral obligation to make the best use of it by growing food? Mark Hill from Deloitte.
Our land quality and our benign growing climate and our predictable weather pattern means that the UK is one of the best places to grow crops in terms of yield per unit of land area. And from a global context, in terms of global environment, it would seem sensible to devote those areas of the world which are best suited to crop production to crop production, and those areas of the world which are best suited to growing forests to continue deforestation. What we are currently seeing is areas of Europe being devoted to environmental gains, which I applaud, but not at the cost of deforestation of the Amazon.
But even with high food prices and a benign climate, farming is actually one of the least profitable uses of a patch of British countryside. Rob Jeffrey and Dave Morris are two former dairy farmers who now run a consultancy, advising people who want to make a living as so-called hobby farmers.
As long as I can remember, the return on your capital invested on land has been minuscule. You're talking 1.5% on the investment in your land if you're actually talking about returns from growing crops. Farmers have made money. They haven't made the money from producing food and selling it. Their fortune has been accrued by the land values rising. Land prices seem to be going up at a tremendous rate.
Yeah, we just heard about 400 acres in Lincolnshire of very poor clay land, which has been sold for £9,000 an acre. And I would have valued that at about between 3,000 and 4,000, 5,000 maximum, but no, it's gone for 9.
One reason land prices are rising is that it's being bought not by commercial farmers, but by people like Rupert Lywood. On the Sunday Times Rich List, he made a fortune from his London finance business and now owns land in Shropshire and Somerset. But he believes people like him should be discouraged.
Where we actually live, and we have the 30 acres, we needed approximately 30 acres for my wife's horses, and it's nice to earn the land around you.
Did you ever consider that you might grow food in it?
Did I consider being a farmer? No.
Are you quite happy with the idea that you have a lot of land that isn't being used for any kind of food production? Do you think that's absolutely fine?
No, not really. I think it's very important that land such as the land I own should be made available for proper food production. And the way land prices are at the moment, that's not going to happen. I think something needs to change. One of the problems with farmland, it is so expensive that it's actually impossible to buy land and make a living out of it as a farmer and pay interest and pay back capital. So something's wrong, and the problem with reduction in land prices, it might encourage more people like me to buy more land around their houses. And so I think actually you have to counter that and use some sort of non-productive levy on land. I think if you have 30 acres around your house and you're deliberately using it for something other than farming, maybe there should be a levy for holding that land.
That's really interesting. So you're suggesting that people who own land, in effect, as you say, just for the fun of it, should suffer some kind of financial penalty brought in by the government?
If somebody is buying land for a non-productive purpose, I think it's perfectly reasonable to have some form of levy to encourage that land to be used for productive purposes.
But the reverse happens. Since the Common Agricultural Policy was reformed in 2003, the government subsidises farmers regardless of whether they're productive or not. Indeed, to get the single farm payment, there's no need for them to do any farming at all. They need only keep their land in good agricultural condition. And the penalties for not doing so aren't exactly severe. According to the EU's rules, if a farmer fails to comply through negligence, direct payments may be reduced by at most 5%. Matt Parsons works for the Eurosceptic think tank Open Europe.
The subsidy is not based on how much farmers grow, the number of animals they keep. It's completely separate from any of the activities that the farmer actually engages in. The land ownership is the key, not the actual farming activity. You can get the single farm payment without doing any actual farming. For example, I mean, you have several London-based multinationals that don't seem to be in any sort of need of any subsidies. About 34 golf courses received these subsidies, real estate-type businesses. There are some railway companies even, a handful of financial services type of companies, veterinary clinics, the Queen, universities, you have churches, pony clubs, and many, many others.
No wonder that the number of people registered as farmers increased from 80,000 to 120,000 after the new subsidies were brought in. Since the payments now have nothing to do with production, a farmer can actually sell his subsidy entitlement to someone else, a landowner in the city, for example, who will get a healthy return on his investment. In effect, the EU agricultural policy now pays non-farmers not to farm.
The big winners out of this system are the landowners. An OECD report estimated that about 24% of the single farm payment end up with actual farmers. And this has a number of side effects. Obviously, it will drive up land prices as land ownership is basically subsidized and artificially high food prices.
And yet the fact that more and more people are buying small plots of land isn't necessarily a bad thing for food production, so long as they do actually farm it. Rob Jeffrey and Dave Morris, the former dairy farmers who now advise would-be new farmers, are positive about their clients.
They're intelligent people who've been very successful in business, but they know nothing about farming. They have no idea at all of how many animals per acre you can feed on that grass, and very often they get overstocked. Usually that overstocking comes from a love of their animals and a reluctance to get rid of them as they breed and multiply.
But you see, these people, they're used to being successful. They're not going to stand by and make mistakes. But what really surprises me, and I think Rob's the same, is the enthusiasm they've got for their little piece of England. Some of them perhaps only got 5, 6, 7 acres, but they showed a lot more enthusiasm for that than I ever did for 250 acres.
You could say that these small farms are lost to commercial farming, But what it does mean is that that particular piece of land is producing more food than it was before under commercial farming system. These individuals are working full-time on their bit of land. The whole plot of land can be farmed and produce a great deal more food than it was before.
Yeah.
And that food is sold locally, and that is why these people can afford to do it. Because when you sell produce direct to the end user, the profit per item can go up by as much as 10 times compared to selling it to a wholesaler.
You see, the most successful of our clients take it one stage further. The most profit you can get out of selling a pig is to turn the old pig into sausage.
To come to farming with an open mind is a tremendous asset. Just the fact that they haven't been indoctrinated, like all of us have, to be prepared to go out and retail their produce. Farmers have never, ever looked at marketing. They've always had their produce marketed for them.
It used to happen a long while ago. There were small farms, 15, 20, 25 acres, where farmer and his wife actually brought up three or four kids off that farm. And the smallholders only going back 50, 60 years to how it used to be done.
There are two models of the future on offer here. One is this kind of intensive but small-scale local agriculture. The other is to encourage international trade in food, maximise British production by getting rid of perverse subsidies, and let land use be determined by democratic politics and a free market. Alan Swinbank, an agricultural economist from Reading University, is in the second camp.
The countryside will continue to change as it has changed over the last 100 years, and that in part will reflect the profitability of different crops and livestock for British farmers, and in part will reflect the demands of the public as they persuade, bribe, encourage farmers to provide alternative sceneries. I mean, I wouldn't have thought, for example, that the horses that predominate in many of the fields around Reading would disappear overnight under more wheat, because I think the urban population will continue to want to ride horses and pay for their upkeep in the vicinities of the big towns.
Everything changes, though, if you factor in the possibility of ever-rising oil prices and the need to cut carbon emissions drastically. As we saw in the first programme in this series, the production of nitrogen fertiliser relies on huge quantities of fossil fuels and is probably unsustainable. So what happens to the British landscape if you try to do without?
If you're under the pressure to produce all your food organically, I think you would be kind of looking at, for instance, getting rid of the million acres of horses that are in this country at the moment. You would start to think that amenity horses were a bit of a luxury.
That's Simon Fairley, who edits a magazine called The Land. He's interested in whether Britain could be self-sufficient in food. The usual answer is that it's not possible. For instance, here's agricultural economist Tim Lloyd.
The UK couldn't feed itself. We just don't have the right type of resources to produce all of the crops and livestock that we need. We're always going to need to buy much of our food from the world market, and common sense tells us that we should do that increasingly. It would be possible to substantially increase the output in the UK, but of course that would come about from increasing the intensity of agriculture, and that will very often mean the increased use of agrochemicals. And in the current pro-environment era that we live in, that's possibly not such an attractive solution.
But what if you had to do it? Simon Fairley looked at three options for a self-sufficient Britain. First, using industrial fertiliser. Second, doing it using organic agriculture and manure from animals. And third, by putting Britain on a vegan diet and using only green manures.
I was using standard agricultural accounting books, and it was fairly clear that all the systems could produce enough food for Britain to feed itself. And basically, these systems were all delivering pretty much what we eat now in terms of nutrition, except less meat, about half as much. It depends how much land you want to leave for wildlife and so on. And it doesn't leave you an enormous amount of land for amenity and wildlife.
Nutritionally, the diet may be adequate, but you can kiss goodbye to your out-of-season strawberries and melons.
If you went back to the last era in which diets did have to change because of food availability, we're talking about the Second World War, then you'll see it is very, very different to today's diet. And I just can't see consumers accepting those sorts of restrictions on what they eat in the absence of a very real threat of war.
Well, I suppose some people would find it boring. I mean, I was brought up on an English diet, really. I was brought up on joints and Yorkshire pudding and apple crumble and junket and all these things, half of it which you don't really get nowadays, and I loved it. I particularly like my greens. But there's turnips and leeks and cabbage and beans, and there's all sorts of ways of preserving things, and you're not going to get the Mediterranean diet, but I'm not sure about the sustainability of that diet. And it's based very much on people having an awful lot of central heating. If you've got to put up with the cold, then you want a good, stodgy, fatty diet.
Many people who think about food and the environment decide that the only sustainable and equitable diet is a vegan one, because growing grain to feed animals is wasteful. But according to Simon Fairley, a post-oil Britain will need its farm animals, especially pigs.
All the fat in northern countries comes from animals, not from plants. And I think that's the problem that vegan people have, because the main source of fat you have in Britain are lard and dripping and butter. The production of vegetable oil is surprisingly expensive. It almost looks as though you need less land to produce fat from pigs. And certainly if you're feeding pigs your waste, which is what pigs are basically for, then you're getting fat a lot cheaper as animal fat than you are as vegetable fat. When I was living on a sort of self-sufficient community where there was a number of vegans and vegetarians, I found it rather frustrating because we were producing quite a lot of fat and protein from the grass that we walked on. You know, one day you're walking on grass, one day it's grass, the next day it's butterfat. And yet this wasn't really being included in the community's diet because there was a high vegan-vegetarian ethos. And instead, the community was bringing in fairly hefty quantities of almonds and palm oil and margarine and Brazil nuts and so forth, while a lot of the meat-based and dairy-based protein and fat that we were producing was not really being used properly. I found that very frustrating.
So that's perhaps our low-carbon future. A heavily cultivated landscape dotted with grazing animals and pigs, and populated by sturdy, apple-crumble-eating yeomen. It may not come to that, and will certainly take a while before we get there, but the days of taking our landscape, like our food, for granted may be coming to a close. Agricultural analyst Mark Hill.
At the moment we are in a position whereby we can devote our countryside into environmental and import our food. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have cheap food and a nice environment at home. If global food production is in short supply, you will one day have to make a choice as to what is most important to you.
Our Food, Our Future was presented by Tom Heap and produced in Bristol by Julian Jenkins. There's a website to accompany the series, an audio slideshow that examines the factors that have contributed to today's global food crisis, narrated by Tom Heap, and a quiz that tests your knowledge about how your food arrives on your plate. We'll find out more on the Radio 4 website. In a quarter of an hour, we begin.